we've gone from a setting where Don and just one or two other people were the only ones that thought marrow transplantation was even possible in the 1950s to today, where there are 100,000 transplants performed worldwide every year, and 40 million people have signed up and registered to be potential stem cell donors. That's a monumental achievement. And if nobody had told the story, I just think that would have been a tragedy, something that would have been lost.
That was Frederick Applebaum, Executive Vice President at Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center and author of the book Living Medicine, Don Thomas, Marrow Transplantation, and the Cell Therapy Revolution. In the book, Applebaum, who became Don Thomas's mentee and collaborator, delves deep into Thomas's work in bone marrow transplantation and its role in curing hematologic cancers. At Fred Hutch, Thomas brought together a team of doctors, nurses, social workers, and experts to treat patients with hematologic cancers using bone marrow transplantation. Applebaum got the call from Thomas to join them in 1977. In this conversation, Applebaum overviews Thomas's fundamental discoveries that led him to receive the Nobel Prize in Medicine in 1990.
And I'd like to begin just when you began working with Don Thomas. What was that like?
What was it like?
I know it's a big question.
Well, I first became aware of Don in 1970 when I was a medical student. And I had a wonderful mentor who was teaching me how to do a physical exam and how to do a workup of a patient. And she was a hematologist by the name of Dr. Jane DeForge, who was just a wonderful hematologist in Boston. And she happened to mention when I was a sophomore in medical school about this radical new therapy that Don Thomas was working on, marrow transplantation. There was another scientist at Tufts Medical School where I was that by the name of Robert Schwartz, who was doing some important work in that area. And the idea of transplantation just seemed amazing to me. It hadn't been worked out in humans yet. They were still trying that. But the idea that you could actually get rid of someone's entire hematopoietic system and transplant a normal one in place of it just seemed extraordinary to me. And so when she mentioned it, I went and read one of Don's earliest works and that he had published in Blood about it. And from then on, don't ask me why, it was like having my brain tattooed. I just couldn't get it out of my mind. It was something that just appealed to me. You know, why does somebody love classical music or someone love poetry? And, you know, there are things that just appeal to us. And then it came time for me to do my fellowship, and I did it at the National Cancer Institute in Bethesda, Maryland. And there I started to do some work in marrow transplantation, which caught Don's attention. And one day, end of 77, the phone rang and it was him calling me up and asking me if I was interested in working with him. And it was like the heavens opened up and God looking down at me and saying, you know, would you like to come? And so it was really quite an honor to be noticed and to be able to work with him from the beginning.
That's fantastic. I imagine that phone call was very exciting for you.
Well, it was very exciting. It lasted about a minute. Don was not one for chit-chat.
Why don't we walk me through, you know, your decision to write a book about this. You know, what went into that?
Well, I think the reason I wanted to write the book was really to memorialize Don and the whole team and everyone really throughout the world that's worked on the topic of marrow transplantation. It's a terrific story. And if it hadn't been told and if the story had been lost to history, I just thought that would be a tragedy. I mean, we've gone from a setting where Don and just one or two other people were the only ones that thought marrow transplantation was even possible in the 1950s to today, where there are 100,000 transplants performed worldwide every year, and 40 million people have signed up and registered to be potential stem cell donors. That's a monumental achievement. And if nobody had told the story, I just think that would have been a tragedy, something that would have been lost. So that was the primary motivation for writing the book. In addition, and I know that no single book makes any measurable difference, but I just thought that anything that increases our scientific literacy in this day and age has to be a good thing.
I think that's really interesting, especially jumping into, you know, why it's important for, you know, young researchers and scientists and people entering the field to learn about this sort of thing. Could you speak to that very briefly?
I think there are a number of lessons that you can get from Don's story. They may not all be applicable to everyone, but you know, if you were to ask what was the sort of secret sauce that Don had, it had lots of ingredients in it. But Don had, of course, he had a terrific idea to start with. So let's start with that. You know, he had this wonderful idea. He didn't know how to do it, but it was a great idea that you potentially could transplant bone marrow, and the implications of that were just enormous. And he did not stray from that. He was, throughout his career, incredibly focused on that goal. So he didn't become much broader. He became much deeper and continued to focus on that with sort of a single-mindedness and a persistence that was really, I think, you know, quite extraordinary. So there's that. The second thing is that he didn't know how to solve the problem, but he kept working one step at a time. And as he said, you know, if he'd gotten to a true dead end, he probably would have quit and tried something else, but he never did. It was the multiple steps it took to achieve the goal. There's a quote from Neil Doctorow, which I like a lot. He was talking about writing, but he said, "It's like driving at night in the fog. You can only see as far as your headlights, but you can make the whole trip that way." And I think that was sort of the lesson from Don, that, you know, you might not know how to solve all the problems, but if you keep one step at a time, you may be able to get there. One other thing about Don was that he knew that it would take many, many different kinds of input to solve the problem. And so he created at the Fred Hutch his own sort of small department of medicine, all just focused on the issue of marrow transplantation. So he was taking in people that were really focused on infectious diseases in the transplant patient, in GI complications in the transplant patient, pulmonary problems in the transplant patient. He had his own dietitians, his own social workers, his own pharmacists. It really took, you know, it's a cliche now, but it did take a village to solve the problem. So I think if you ask me what Don's, you know, what was unique about Don, it was his focus, his persistence, his ability to draw a team to solve a very difficult problem.
That's wonderful. I'd love to maybe take a step back to the beginning and talk about how we got to, you know, the reality of that team and that village existing. I want to talk about his time in Boston and his experiences with Dr. Sidney Farber. Would you be able to get into that all a little bit?
Yeah, so Don, when he was in, he got into medical school in an unusual way, actually. It was during the buildup in World War II. And in World War II, there was suddenly this huge shortage of physicians because so many physicians were being taken out to take care of the military. And so there was not a lot of physicians left at home. And so Harvard and a few, you know, some other medical schools started taking new classes every 9 months and condensing the training into 3 years and providing funding for the housing and for the tuition. And Don was he was dirt poor. He couldn't afford to go to medical school. He was in this little town in Texas. But when that was available. He applied for that special training and was able to be accepted at Harvard. When he was at Harvard, he saw different diseases, but leukemia was one, and he was instantly drawn to leukemia. In his own words, I won't quote this exactly, but he said, it was a terrible disease. People were dying within, you know, weeks to months. And he just felt he owed it to patients to try and do better. And with leukemia, you could take a drop of blood from a vein and you can actually see the malignant cells. So it's like a biopsy as opposed to, you know, pancreatic cancer where you can't get your hands on the tissue. So studying leukemia just made sense to him because it was something that was a terrible disease, but you had ready access to the cells. When he was there, Sidney Farber he was able to be part of he took a hematology fellowship there. And while he was there, he was able to see Sidney Farber treating the very first children with Amenopterin with an anti-metabolite and getting some complete remissions. Now, the complete remissions were short-term, but this was the first time people were really seeing complete remissions in acute leukemia. And so Don was very drawn by that. He then read about the spleen shielding experiments that were going on by a guy by the name of Leon Jacobson. And that suggested to Don that marrow transplantation might be possible. He was at the Brigham at that time, and Farber was his boss, and he wanted to try some experiments to do this, but Farber thought it was a terrible idea and wouldn't give him any space. Interestingly, Farber had become surprisingly conservative after his first successes with single agent chemotherapy and didn't even want to try combination chemotherapy, much to the chagrin of some other of the investigators at the time. And so Don had this idea, but unfortunately wasn't able to pursue it at the Brigham because he had no space. So that was when he decided that he would prefer to pursue the idea than to stay at Harvard. And that's when he moved to Cooperstown.
Interesting. And so it was at Cooperstown that he began conducting bone marrow transplants in humans and in animals. Is that right?
Yes. So he, in 1956, he moved to Cooperstown to work with a guy by the name of Joe Farabee. Farabee had been at Harvard and Don had met him at that time. They were there together. And Farabee was doing some research in what was then a pretty nascent field of immunology. And Farabee also had the idea of the potential for marrow transplantation. And so when Farabee and Thomas got together, they really wanted to pursue this idea. And so they did. And they both did some early experiments in a canine model, but also in humans. And in 1956, they did their first human transplants, which everyone failed very quickly in six patients that were actually reported in the New England Journal. But you could give marrow intravenously at least, and it didn't all just clog up in the lungs. There was perhaps short-term engraftment in one of the patients, but only really temporary and very minor. It certainly was a failure by any stretch of the imagination. But that was when they started. And Don realized that he needed to have an animal model in which to conduct his work if he was ever going to make it work in humans. He chose to work in a canine model. And there was, I suspect today there would be a lot of pushback and controversy about that. And it wasn't as if Don didn't like dogs. I mean, Don was a great outdoorsman and a terrific hunter, both ducks and deer. But, you know, for a duck hunter, your retriever is like a family member. And it was for Don. Right. But the reason he chose to work in dogs is that all the mouse experiments at the time were using inbred mice. And the immunology of inbred mice can teach you certain principles for sure, but it's nothing like the outbred human species. And that's what Don wanted to try and do, is work, develop a cure for patients. And so he chose the canine model where it is an outbred species, and you do have litters. So it's much like families in humans, where you can have things that are akin to brother and sister.
Right. I'm curious, in 1957, there was a little piece in your book about the Blood Club. And it was expressed that, you know, people were disturbed and a little dismayed when they heard about Dr. Thomas's and Dr. Farabee's work. Would you mind talking about that a little bit? Just, you know, I'm curious about this Blood Club. What an interesting name.
Well, it was a group of individuals that were sort of the precursor to the American Society of Hematology, people that were interested in research in hematology. And they would pick different topics to discuss each year. They would have a meeting, and then one topic would be the central topic. In 1957, there was enough interest in marrow transplantation as a potential science for them to meet. And they did meet. And as you point out, Alex, there were different people presenting the little work that they had done in animal models. That was the first time that Don and Joe Farabee presented their information. They had actually tried this in humans, and there was a lot of pushback saying, we're not ready to do that, and please don't do that, you know, that there just isn't enough knowledge to think that it would have much a chance of success. I think that's a tension that happens all the time, you know, that there are people who want to push the envelope a little bit more, and other people who are more conservative about it. Certainly today, there are different regulations that didn't exist at the time that Don was doing this work. You know, you could argue, is that good or bad? I'll just say it's different.
You mentioned earlier that beautiful quote about the fog and the headlights. You know, what is it that kept him researching, trying new things?
You know, I some people would say it's determination. I'm not sure that that's the right word, because to me, determination is something that's totally internally generated. It's sort of like the push. I think for Don, it was not a push. I think it was a pull. I think it was the pull of the potential cure of patients with horrible diseases. And it was just so appealing that you might be able to figure out a cure for these horrible diseases that kept Don working in that direction. You know, you mentioned the ethics of it. We, as I say, it was a different time. But Don was, you know, for those of us who worked with him, I don't think any of us ever had any question any time about his ethics. He was, you know, as far as informed consent was concerned, he had, you know, really in-depth conversations with every family member and every patient as he was going along. It may have not been as formalized as it is today, but it certainly happened. And Don was a stickler all the way through that everything be done by the book the way it was supposed to be done.
In your book, you know, you talked about the important role that Dottie Thomas played in sort of being his support and, you know, being a great part of his success. Would you mind speaking to that a little bit?
Not at all. You know, I have no doubt whatsoever that if Dottie had decided to go to medical school or become a science writer or anything else, she would have done it and had succeeded enormously. But again, you know, it was a different time and things do change. She was willing, and not just willing, she was eager to help Don in his success. And a lot of us would say that if Don was the father of marrow transplantation, then Dottie was surely the mother. She was, when they met when they were in college, she was a major in journalism at the University of Texas. When they got to Boston, they had no money. It was paid for again by the government. But they only paid for Don's medical school training and also a room in a dormitory where Dottie couldn't stay. They were married. So Don, when they started, was staying in a dormitory and she was staying in a rooming house. And she got a job first as working for the Navy and then as a medical technician. And working as a medical technician turned out to be really vital. When Don got to Cooperstown, Dottie became eventually his lab technician and headed his laboratory there because there was not enough other technicians around to do it. When they finally moved to Seattle, she was not just a help in his technician, but she was, because of her journalism background, she would edit his papers and his grants. And she was there at his side when they would drive to work in the morning. She would have a copy of Current Contents on her lap, and they would circle the papers they wanted to send reprints for. And at 11:30 every day, she would go and get his lunch heated up, and the two of them would eat lunch together in his office between 11:30 and 12 sharp. I mean, she was beside him the entire time. When we would send a paper, when we'd write papers, they would be reviewed by both Don and Dottie. And Don's comments would always be in blue pen, and they would be conceptual, and Dottie's would always be in red, and would make sure that there were no split infinitives, that data was plural, and that there was, you never started a sentence with the undefined it. So she was terrific. It was fun to work with them both.
It's so fun to hear you sort of speak about their relationship. It sounds like they were so complimentary to one another.
Amazingly so. And you talk to the kids. They have three children, if you talk to them, they'll talk about their parents in glowing terms. But Elaine, who's also a physician, an infectious disease physician, said, you know, they were always together and always working, except when they were hunting and fishing. That was and family. That was it.
Jumping ahead a little bit, you talked about this pull that Dr. Thomas had towards sort of finding a cure for these hematologic diseases. Let's talk about the first breakthrough. What was that moment for Dr. Thomas?
Well, I think there were there were several of them. The first perhaps was when he knew that in the late 1950s, he had a couple kids who had leukemia, small children, who happened to have identical twins. And he gave them very high doses of radiation that he knew in an animal model would destroy bone marrow, and you wouldn't recover your blood counts after that much radiation. But because they had identical twins, he was able to give radiation and then a marrow infusion from an identical twin. And while the kids weren't cured, their leukemia did come back. They recovered their blood counts very rapidly. And then in 1960, he had a patient with aplastic anemia who he did the same thing, that is, gave him identical twin marrow. And she rapidly recovered within 2 weeks. In fact, she's still alive today. As is her twin. They were transplanted in 1960. That's the first person on the face of the earth who was ever cured with a marrow transplant. They still, as I say, are doing well. So that was the first insight that you definitely could transplant bone marrow, but it was only in identical twins, but at least he knew that for sure you could transplant bone marrow. Then the second big breakthrough was in the late 60s, early 70s, when HLA typing had evolved enough that it was possible to choose among siblings a donor who was HLA compatible with the recipient. And that allowed Don to make the leap from just this rare identical twin setting to the more relevant setting of brothers and sisters who are HLA identical. In the very first transplants that were done that allowed for cure of leukemia in 1971. Now, there had been also a few years earlier, some transplants for kids with who had immune deficiencies, also using siblings who were HLA compatible. So those were the two big things, that you could do transplants in twins, and then that you could overcome the histocompatibility barrier by selecting donors and recipients who are HLA matched.
I want to talk more about too, like the field's receptiveness to all of this. In the book, I saw that you heard Dr. Thomas speak at the 1975 meeting of the AACR, I believe, and some of the recollections of, well, why don't we just get into like your reaction to his talk and then what you heard others say?
Well, you know, Don was extraordinarily matter of fact. He would tell you, this is what we did, here's what happened. He was not saying that this was right or wrong. He wasn't saying that this was the future. He was just, here's what we did, here's what happened. You know, it's up to you to make your conclusions from that. And I was, as I say, I was blown away that you could actually take patients who had end-stage leukemia and transplant them and cure some of them. Now, the problem was that you're only curing, you know, at the end of the day, between 12 and 14% of the patients. And many of the others, you probably were hastening their death because there was a lot of toxicity from the transplants. People were dying from the mucositis, from infections, from CMV infections. There were lots of problems. Now, the patients that Don was transplanting also would have been dead in another month or two had you done nothing, because they had end-stage leukemia. There is a, you know, there's two phrases in medicine that stand in direct opposition. One is from Hippocrates, you know, who said, first, do no harm. And then there's the other quote often from Shakespeare that says that diseases desperate are by desperate appliance cured or not at all. And those two stand in direct opposition. So if you have someone that has a end-stage disease, is it better to do nothing and let the disease take its course? Or is it better to try something, understanding that you may be causing a lot of toxicity, pain, and anguish, and the chances of success are small? I don't have the right answer to this. I mean, I don't know that anyone does. But I think the people that get to make the choice should be the patients more than anyone else. And as I say, Don explained the situation, and not just Don, but the team explained the situation to these patients, and they wanted to try. And so when he presented this data at the AACR meeting, I was sitting in the back of the room. And of course, I was a young trainee at the time. I was just at the NCI, and I was, you know, I just thought it was spectacular. But I heard a lot of the colleagues saying, that's butchery, you know, that's immoral. Look at how many patients are dying. These guys are cowboys that shouldn't be doing this work. So there was a lot of controversy at the time, a huge amount. But, you know, as I say, there's lots of ways of looking at the same problem. I'm not saying that one group was right and one group was wrong, just different.
I'd love to sort of talk about, sort of moving forward, you know, the tides are changing, how progress was made, and how sort of Don Thomas and your team went about developing supportive care and things like that, how these sorts of developments progressed.
There were so many problems that Don and the team faced during the early days. There was the problem of these infections that were oftentimes early on bacterial and fungal, and then turns out many of them were viral as well. And he brought in infectious disease experts, including Joel Myers and some others, to work with him to try and solve these. And we went to extraordinary efforts to try and prevent infections, including putting patients into laminar airflow rooms where they would stay for 50 days eating sterile food and constantly being bathed in antibiotics. It was very hard on the patients. But, you know, it did prevent early infections. The patients had horrible mucositis, and so it was very difficult for them to eat. But early on, patients literally were starving to death during the transplant procedure. A pediatric nephrologist by the name of Bob Hickman was working at Seattle Children's at the time, and Don asked Bob to come over and see if he could place some catheters, arterial venous shunts, which Bob did. But arterial venous shunts are really dangerous and clot off in a short time. But at the time, they were also doing some early work with a new material called silastic, which was more compatible with the blood system. And so you could start to develop catheters that were indwelling. And so Bob helped invent what now is called the Hickman catheter, which I think is used worldwide. And so suddenly we had a way of not having to poke the kids every morning and every evening. And we, not only could you draw blood, but you can give infusions, and you could also start to give hyperalimentation so they wouldn't be starving. The poor patients were coming to Seattle, and they had, their whole lives were upset. And while Don was trying to do the best he could to care for them, he wasn't doing much for their social problems. There was a young boy by the name of Stephen McCarty who came free plastic anemia, and he was cured with a transplant. His mother, Marion, was a social worker from Southern California. And after the transplant, when they were getting ready to go home, she asked to meet with Don. And she told Don that she wanted, having seen what she saw, she wanted to move to Seattle. She wanted to pick up every patient at the airport that was coming and help them while they're going through the transplant. Don said, "Well, that's an amazingly important thing, but I don't have a salary for you to do that." She said, "That's okay. I'll do it for free." Wow. And so she moved to Seattle for 2 years, worked as the first social worker until Don finally was able to find her a salary. And finally, there's a ton of other people that's worked, but Don, you know, he created his own ward because he didn't trust the care that patients would get anywhere else. And key to that ward were the nurses. Don often referred to the nurses as a secret weapon. And they were incredibly, it takes a certain kind of nurse to be able to work with incredibly ill patients, knowing early on that, you know, 7 or 8 out of 10 were going to die. But to give them the very best care they could, as long as they could, with the hope that there would be the survivors. And some of those nurses, some of the very first nurses, are still here 50 years later, participating in long-term research and care. So those are just a few of the supportive care kinds of things that helped early on. It was infections, it was nutrition, it was, you know, blood support, it was nursing, it was social work, it was everything.
Yeah, it's really interesting to hear how he sort of built that village you spoke of in the beginning, sort of from the ground up, like especially that social worker story. That's just incredible.
Yeah, it was, part of it was Don recruiting people, but more than half of it wasn't him recruiting. It was people coming, wanting to work, volunteering and gravitating towards him rather than him necessarily going out and grabbing them.
Is there anything else I missed or anything else that you'd like to, you know, just get out there?
Well, I want to talk for a minute about the future of Don's work. That is not just the fact that he developed a curative therapy for that's used 100,000 times a year, but the implications of that, which are really profound. And so I think that the Don found developed three principles that were really important that stand out. The first is that with marrow transplantation, you can cure virtually every marrow-based disease, including sickle cell anemia, leukemia, lymphoma, and hundreds of others. Second, that part of the way that transplantation cures leukemia is that the transplanted immune system sees the leukemia as foreign and rejects it. And third, that after a marrow transplant, lifelong immune suppression is not necessary, that you develop bidirectional tolerance. Now, the implications of those three principles are what's going to shape the future of medicine to a large extent. The first, the fact that you can cure any marrow-based disease means that for inherited marrow-based diseases like sickle cell anemia and thalassemia, what we will be doing in the future is not relying on someone else's bone marrow, but we will be able to take the patient's own bone marrow and using techniques that are already available, we will be able to correct the defect and transplant the repaired product back into the patient themselves, sort of auto transplant. That's already being done in sickle cell anemia and thalassemia, and the approach is already approved by the FDA. This will be something that will be done for not just those diseases, but for virtually every, certainly monogenic, marrow-based disease that's due to a single gene defect. That's going to change the face of medicine. The second principle that the new immune system sees the disease as being foreign means that what we will be doing is we will be able to take cells from either the donor or the patient and genetically engineer those immune cells to specifically attack the patient's tumor. That's adoptive immunotherapy, and that's what you've been hearing about CAR T cells and TCRs. That is a direct result of the work that Don Thomas did, that we can draw a direct line from Don's first observation of the graft versus leukemia effect to the development of CAR T cell therapy. And third, the fact that you can get immune tolerance after an allogeneic transplant and not need lifelong immune suppression means that if you first do a bone marrow transplant, that individual would then be tolerant to any solid organ from the donor, including a kidney, for example. So that's already been done. You do a small bone marrow transplant, a mini transplant, and then you can do a kidney transplant from the donor, and the patient doesn't have to be on immune suppression for the rest of their life. There's a long way to go, but boy, would that solve huge problems for kidney, heart, liver transplantation. So the implications of what Don did are not just the development of marrow transplantation, which is huge in and of itself, but the implications are really changing the face of medicine, which is why in the book, I talk about the fact that this is not just about marrow transplantation, but it's also about this revolution in cell therapy.
Absolutely. It's so interesting to hear how sort of Don Thomas laid the foundation for all of this wonderful work that's being done today.
Yeah. Well, of course, other people might see it differently, but looking at it through the lens of a bone marrow transplanter, that's the way I see it.
Thank you for listening to the Cancer History Project podcast, podcasts of oral histories and interviews with the people who have shaped oncology as we know it. Our archives are available online for free at cancerhistoryproject.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at @CancerHistProj. The Cancer History Project is a collaborative historical resource operated by the Cancer Letter. This is an ongoing project and would not be possible without the input and materials provided by our editorial board, our contributors, and the support of our sponsors, including Cedars-Sinai, Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center, MD Anderson Cancer Center, and many others. View a full list of our sponsors at cancerhistoryproject.com/sponsors. If your institution would like to participate in the Cancer History Project, email us at admin@cancerhistoryproject.com.